Welcome to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, and I'm hosting this series about the institutions which foster international cooperation in monetary and economic affairs, initiated in 1944 at that historic conference at Bretton Woods. In the second segment of the podcast series, we will look at the major multilateral development banks, commonly referred to as the MDBs. The World Bank and the regional development banks that followed from its creation, namely the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, are sometimes referred to as the, quote, legacy MDBs, unquote. We will also look at the two most recently created multilateral development banks, the New Development Bank, also known as the BRICS Bank, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, to explore why they were created and how they're similar to and different from other multilateral development banks. Finally, we'll discuss the role and function of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has a different mission and composition, but relates to many of the other institutions we've covered in this podcast series. As background, our last podcast gave us an overview of the evolving theories of economic development, the many sources and purposes of development financing and assistance, and how the participants relate in order to see where the MDBs fit into this larger development ecosystem. In three podcasts, we will be discussing the World Bank, its purpose, what it does, how it does it. We have as our guest someone with a deep practical experience in the institution, Joachim Levy. Joachim is Director of Economic Strategy and Market Relations at Banco Safra. Prior to joining the bank, he had extensive experience working in several of the international institutions we're discussing in the podcast series, including the IMF, the Inter-American Development Bank, and most relevant to today's podcast, the World Bank, where he was the Chief Financial Officer. He also has worked with the World Bank as a senior government official in a member country and borrower from the bank. Joaquim was an official in the Brazilian Treasury, became Brazil's finance minister, as well as president of the Brazilian Development Bank. So I'm sure you'll agree that Joaquim brings a wealth of experience in economic development issues, development finance, and in the MDBs to our conversation today. Thank you, Joaquim, for taking the time for this discussion.
Thank you. Very good to be with you, and I hope we have an exciting and informative conversation.
I'm sure we will. So before we begin our conversation, let me give the listeners a bit of a background about the World Bank. As they will recall from our first podcast, like the IMF, the bank's origins were in the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference. The bank's formal name is the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and the concept was that the bank would help to rebuild war-torn economies after World War II ended. A number of delegates to the Bretton Woods Conference, such as those from Latin America, insisted that the bank also be engaged in helping with economic development of its members and not just post-war reconstruction. The purpose of the bank, as stated in its charter, expressly provides to providing finance for both post-conflict reconstruction, but also to the encouragement of the development of productive facilities and resources in less developed countries. As it turned out, while the initial loans made by the World Bank, once it was operational, were to the Europeans, those relatively small loans mainly were for general purposes, such as paying for imports, and were merely a stopgap until the Marshall Plan, that is, the U.S. plan for economic recovery of Europe, was up and running. The World Bank at that time only had an initial capital of $10 billion, and in fact, merely $720 million of it was actually available for lending in those early years. In contrast, the Marshall Plan disbursed over $13 billion from the U.S. from 1948 until it ended in 1952. So the World Bank clearly was not adequate for addressing the enormous post-war reconstruction effort. So it was good, in fact, that development was the other purpose of the World Bank, or one might wonder why it lasted and grew to the important institution it is today. Of course, over the years, there were unfortunately plenty of conflicts that gave opportunities for the bank to address post-war reconstruction, too, in a number of countries. We learned in the last podcast with Masoud Ahmed that what fosters economic growth in different countries varies greatly, depending on many factors such as their resources, their population, their current stage of development, their institutions and capacity to govern and address the needs of their populations. And this, of course, is not a static analysis, but a dynamic one. So in this series, we'll see how the World Bank's development mission evolved and how, like the IMF, the bank changed to adapt to changing economic theories and to a changing world. So now let's dive into the questions. I think a good place to start our understanding of how the World Bank operates is its unique financial model, which is generally used for the other legacy MDBs as well. The model permits the bank to raise most of its funding for its activities by borrowing in capital markets. So today we're going to explain what it means to operate as a bank in the development context, rather than as a bilateral donor of aid transfers. So over to you, Joachim, if you can explain that to us.
Okay, yes, the World Bank is a partnership among nations, but it's also a financial institution and that relies on the market, like you said, to achieve its goals. Its financial model is based on the capital that countries have contributed and also capital they have promised to contribute if needed in the future. This capital, like in any other bank, allows the institution to approach markets and raise funds by giving a guarantee that they can support these loans if something happens. So this allows the World Bank to leverage its capital. And leverage means exactly that the money that the bank lends is itself borrowed. It belongs to the investors who bought the bonds issued by the bank, trusting that the bank will always honor these bonds in full. That is, investors will get their money back plus interest. Now, how much the bank can borrow and then lend, and at what cost and at which maturities, depends on the capital available as well as on a number of other factors.
So tell us some about those other factors, Joachim.
Well, these factors involve, for instance, the commitment of shareholders and borrowers to the bank, the quality and the way management and staff operate, and the standards that they have, as well as the leverage itself. And these are the factors that affect the cost and tenure of the bonds issued at the bank. If everything is in place, market will consider that the bank is a very safe place and the bonds it issues are low risk and can be fully trusted. In this case, investors will charge an interest rate that is close to that charged when they buy government bonds from the US, Germany, Japan. And these rates, of course, are much lower than the ones charged by the market to developing countries. So with that, the bank will be able to offer to these developing countries long-term, low-cost loans. And the countries will strive to never default these bonds, allowing the bank to pay back its bonds in full with their maturity and keep the whole process moving.
So as you said, the interest rate the borrowers are getting is considerably less than if they tried to tap the private markets themselves, because they're getting the rates that would be paid by a AAA issuer of debt. Is this model one that can work for funding and lending for all World Bank Group loans?
Well, you made a very important comment. We are talking about World Bank, but as you explained in the beginning, The original World Bank is IBRD, the Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is the core institution. Over time, and we can discuss this, other institutions associated under the umbrella of the World Bank were developed for specific objectives. And in a way, every one of these institutions do operate under the same principle, which is the trust of investors, the help of investors to provide the funding for the institution, backed by the capital of the institution, as well as the quality of the portfolio, which is a function of the work and decisions of staff, management, etc. In some of these institutions, like the IDA, which is the International Development Agency, that is focused towards poor countries, the leverage is much smaller. And until a few years back, there was no leverage whatsoever. So this is the model for IBRD, but works for all the institutions. And like also you mentioned, is a template also for the other development banks.
Yeah. And I guess with IDA, you try to offer more concessional rates of interest, lower rates of interest to the borrowers. So obviously, there's a need to tap into the capital of IDA potentially for that of capital retained earnings. And that, I guess, over the years had led to a number of kind of capital replenishments for the institution so that they could be providing that concessional level of loans. So in terms of the consequences of this model of tapping markets for leverage to build up the available lending assets of the bank, how does that actually affect the lending activities of the bank?
Well, just to explore a little bit more the funding, architecture. First, actually, you know, some of the advanced economies are not AAA anymore, or not universally AAA. So, and these actually do have a cost in their borrowing activities. But the World Bank is a AAA, and I think there is a quite of a consensus that it's very important to be a AAA. Now, there's another factor that is specific to the IBRD, which is the so-called preferred status, credit status of the IBRD that helps keeping this AAA. What is that? Is that if by any chance you do have a default, and the country runs in trouble and so on, and it owes to a lot of institutions, IBRD, you'll be the first one to be paid, and you'll be paid in full. And other institutions will be their junior, which means sometimes they would have to have some haircuts in the value of their credits. So the fact that the IBRD is the first one and is meant to be paid in full is a major factor to the quality of its borrowing. The other factor is that, as I mentioned, it has a certain amount of capital, but it also has an additional capital that's called callable capital. So it's a capital that the shareholders will bring to the bank. Now, this capital is not really meant to backstop ongoing losses, credit losses of the bank. It's more a political guarantee meant to tell the investors, those who are buying the bonds, that if by any chance, for whatever reason, the bank is at some point dissolved, discontinued, the governments, the shareholders will make sure that every bond will be paid, even in these extreme conditions. So these are the two things that are very fundamental to the whole model. Now, as we discussed before, leverage is a major factor. And here, as you know, if you increase leverage, there's less capital to backstop losses, you get riskier. And what you have to be careful about increasing the leverage of the World Bank is that As you increase the leverage and the borrowing cost becomes higher, this difference between the interest rate that the World Bank will charge and the interest rate that the best clients of the World Bank can get in the market will narrow. And if it gets too narrow, the best clients of the bank may refrain from using the bank, which means that the overall quality of the lending portfolio of the bank will worsen. And as markets will see that, they will find that overall proposition is even riskier, and they may increase even more the cost of their funding. And this may, at the end, require that shareholders will put more capital to make the whole, say, functioning really effective. So it's a factor that the risk management of the bank is always very attentive, and it's always talking with shareholders, because of course we want to get maximum mileage to every dollar in capital. But to the extent that it's a financial institution that depends on markets and the willingness of markets to fund the operations, you have to keep that exactly at levels that to ensure that the bank remains a AAA. So given that, and maybe I got a lot of the details on the financial side, but these are important, especially when you're thinking that, I mean, the bank has to spend because there's new and new challenges. And this also affects the type of loans, et cetera, that the bank can give.
Right.
And
right.
Always.
I mean, leverage can, yeah, the leverage cannot be infinite. And you said that in managing the loan portfolio that you need to make sure that it's high quality, that these loans are going to perform. And as you just explained, that they also need to be diversified, both in terms of who's borrowing and the kind of composition of the credits. And this is all part of getting the high investment rating on World Bank bonds and keeping its cost of borrowing low. We need to talk, I think, a bit about the bank's lending and how it really takes place. Assuming a member country wants the bank to be involved in financing a development need in the country, what happens in terms of, you know, whether these loans can be made, and then what happens in terms of just the process of the loan itself?
Okay, yes. You see, we talk about leverage, quality, all of that, mm-hmm. but really a very important part of the perceived quality of the loan portfolio of the bank is the governance that backs every loan that's extended by the bank. Of course, the specifics of each loan may vary because the problems the country may be trying to address, and therefore the kind of loan it may be seeking or need will be different country by country, situation by situation. But there are certain general principles that have to be observed. So there are different types of loans, different sizes, but the process more or less the same. And I think that let me talk a bit about the two basic types of loans. The first one, which is the most
right.
classic loan, is the so-called the project loans. And it's where really the bank started decades ago, which was to finance a dam, a road, etc. These are projects that are behind that. The second type of loan that became very popular in the last 20, 30 years is so-called budget support loan. And this is important because often what the country has to do is not just to build a specific item, but to make reforms, to make the economy to work better, and in this way improve people's life in the medium term. But to achieve this, sometimes there are some sacrifice to be made. Also, sometimes you need these reforms, and you get ready to make these reforms when the country is going through rough times. So the government needs help to keep things moving as you change the structure. And this is why it's called the budget support loan. So the loan is not for a specific, say, to spend in a specific activity, because sometimes it's just a change of in a regulation, a change in a program, and these do not necessarily require money. But for the government to have the legitimacy, the ability, the political ability to implement these things, they need to continue to run. And if you're in a tough time, you may need this type of support. But again, they are not just to keep the government running. It's really to afford to make it possible to do the changes. And then they have to be discussed with the authorities, and they have to have very clear purpose and very clear, say, objectives.
So, in terms of operationally, I understand that it's very much the World Bank country teams who kind of start that dialogue and that process, and they're very much at the center of the kind of loan assessment and identifying appropriate roles for the World Bank in financing a development plan or program. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Yes, exactly. So how you figure out what has to be done, either where you put a road or what kind of road, or like these reforms and so on. So the core of this is a discussion between the authorities and the bank staff. And why it's so important, these conversations? Often because the staff have seen how countries have successfully done these projects, a road, a reform, whatever. And sometimes also the staff knows about the places where some experiences were not successful. And this is very important, because this helps also governments to avoid actions that could work against their intent. So you go through all this discussion. After you get an agreement on the size, the objectives, the condition for the loans, you can then make a loan proposal. This will, of course, be approved by the authorities. I mean, usually most countries do have a process on their own also to approve internally these things. And then when everything is set, this is sent to the board of directors of the bank. This is the governance level of the bank. And the fact that there is some discussion if directors should look at every loan, etc. Of course, the amount of time the directors spend on each loan will vary. But this review, this stance, makes sure that every loan adheres to the goals of the bank and satisfies the best risk management practices also of the bank. This will ensure, from one side, that we have more chance to get meaningful outcomes, and also that the loan portfolio of the bank is really balanced and very well understood, which again will protect the financial health of the bank. And this can take a little bit of time, but I believe it's very important to ensure this consistency and the quality of the bank's operation and the trust in the bank.
Well, that's right, and that's all part of the fact that the bank is financing itself by going to markets, and there needs to be that confidence. Well, in our last podcast, we talked about how evolving economic theories based on development assistance experience change the assessments over time about what should be prioritized in assistance and financing for development in different contexts. And you've alluded to that as well, the move from projects to budget loans. But can you talk a little bit more about the World Bank's lending operations and priorities and how they changed over time to reflect those changing economic analytics, but also to meet evolving or critical needs?
Yes, the types and goals of loans have changes, and the bank is an institution that is always learning from experience and also what's going on around the world. And the challenges that come to the bank have changed over time. Like I mentioned, the general structure of the economy matters, and sometimes you have to find ways to change that. Also, how you support health, education, opportunities, especially for women and minorities. These are core part of the banks. We at the bank, people know that education and health is fundamental for the productivity of people. So even if you talk in economic terms, get this right is very important. It's part of the overall development of nations. And these sometimes, again, are soft issues. It's not only a question of, say, financing a clinic or a school, but also the way these schools would operate, the incentives that workers have, and so on. And sometimes these are very sophisticated things, and the bank can help the same way it helps to protect the minorities, get the right incentives, and so on. So again, in these cases, you may have loans that are based on changing the way the economy, the way the fabric of the country works, more than just the hardware. And this is very interesting because, for instance, think about 30 years ago when with the fall of the Berlin Wall, a large part and a quite large number of countries start to undergo very important changes. The whole structure of the economy would change from a socialistic structure with all its incentives and the way organized to something more of capital markets and this kind of thing. So the bank had a very, very important role in helping these economics to transform themselves and operate in this new environment. And for instance, it would help the government when they had to close state-owned economies that would be money loss companies, but then they would have a lot of say liabilities to their workers, and how we integrate these in the government budget and so on. This is the type of thing that the bank played a very important role, as well as other institutions to have a market economy.
Yeah, no, it's fundamental changes, and it affected every aspect of the economy and the political economy. So, does the bank, when it lends, only lend to national governments at that level? Or?
Not really. I mean, part of the learning process was that for a lot of these changes, like I mentioned, think about schools, women, minorities, a lot of things will be even at a municipal level or at subnational level in more general terms. And this is particularly true in large countries. Think about India, Brazil, even China. So the bank very often works with subnational official subnational governments. However, the shareholder of the banks are the national governments. So typically, there will be a guarantee from the national government covering these loans. Again, because we need to be sure that the loans will be paid in full, that there will be adequate financial backing to any loan so that you preserve the AAA. So we deal with the people at sort of national level, but often we get some backing from the national level to be sure that the portfolio has the right level of assurances.
Now, the current focus of bank lending has changed a bit, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of these changes.
Oh, yes. I think this is getting more and more important, and probably we can talk a lot about that. But let me just give a feeling here. You see, when the bank was built, often you think about specific problems of specific countries, and you try to literally to save one country at a time. But you have realized that a lot of things that are common. Sometimes the economists will say there are externalities, and sometimes it's even more than externality, which means that you cannot solve a problem individually because the incentives will not be right, and you need some sort of external coordination so that everybody does a little bit, even if they don't see the immediate reward of doing that, so that when you get everybody doing the right thing, the results really show up. And there's no better example of that as climate. But you can think also about, for instance, pandemics. It's not enough that you protect yourself if this is not coordinated across your neighbors and so on and so forth. It's much more efficient if you work together. So the bank is also learning to operate at this level. And being a global institution where you have all countries involved and a strong governance, I think it's very well positioned to do that. So, in some ways, this is a new frontier for the bank that's really worth discussing and learning about.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, if we didn't have global institutions like the World Bank and the IMF with their universal membership. To try to deal with these highly integrated and global problems, we'd have to try to invent them now while we're solving the problems, which would not be too easy. Thank you, Joachim, for giving us a very complete explanation of how the World Bank is structured and operates, with its funding and capital markets backed by paid-in and callable capital from its members and its income and reserves. In order to keep its own borrowing costs as low as possible, and pass on that benefit in what it charges as interest on its loans, the bank must be prudent in the volume of debt it incurs and in the quality and diversification of its loan portfolio. You also gave us a wonderful overview of how the type of loans made by the World Bank has evolved over time as analyses of what is required for economic development change, particularly in changing economic conditions. Our next two podcasts will continue with our look at the World Bank Group and what it does. Please continue with us as Joachim and I explore the terrain more deeply.